Welcome to the latest podcast from the Watercolors Aquarium Gallery, brought to you from the Aquarium Rush Studios in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Today we are highlighting Charles for this video, this podcast. We're talking all about plants. Basically, we're just going to let Charles go.
I don't think you know me very well.
I'm just kidding. As you all know, we give Charles a lot of crap for not being a huge Planet Aquarium fan. Not because he doesn't like Planet Aquariums, but he's a fish guy.
Right. So. And this one I finally have notes for. Because I'm really excited about this subject.
So my name is Ben.
I'm Amy.
And I'm Charles.
And we're going to talk about plants today. Specifically, we kind of made up a fun list about the plants we think are some of the most underrated plants in the hobby. So these are the plants that we get them in sometimes when we can. We see them. They don't sell as well as we think they should.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about them, not just so that they sell more, but because they're really cool plants and you should try them. They're awesome.
Yeah, because I get really excited about some things and then people choose something else that I don't think is as cool. And that's not fair.
Yeah, I don't like that one that much. What's wrong with you?
Okay. Whatever. Although, it's your tank.
On my list of plants, I was just looking at it and they come from a pretty far range of like types of plants. They're not very similar, but they are all the same color, which I realized after I made the list, so maybe I do have a type.
So Amy's going to talk about red plants. Charles is going to talk about all plants that help breed fish better.
Yep.
And I'm going to talk about lots of funky leaf patterns.
The color is not red.
No. What?
Because I think red plants are overrated.
Ooh. I'm going to make a new list about all red plants. Ah!
Oh, darn. That would be so rough.
I'm going to do an alternate. I might do some.
Yeah. Red plants are great, but I don't get... The red frenzy is a little much. There are some gorgeous green plants, and maybe that's why I think they're underrated.
All right. So we're going to give a shout out to a friend of ours because of the red plant thing that you just brought up. At the Aquatic Gardeners Association in last year, we had the pleasure of meeting Esther Mouse from Aquaflora.
Yes.
She is this amazing plant growing person. She has this incredible business in Holland, not Holland, Michigan, in the Netherlands.
And I wish.
We can't get her plants here. They can't ship to the United States. In her showroom, she has a tank. Okay, I'm starting my list.
I already know what you're talking about.
I know.
And you're right.
I know.
I'm sitting over here like, I have no idea what this ending is because I did not go to this convention.
So this plant to me has a very long history. Karen Randall, another shout out to one of our Planet Aquarium friends, brought this plant to my attention. The plant is Barclaya longifolia, and it is a very large, fantastically growing, beautiful red plant. It reminds me a lot of Aponogetans, but it's really a cool red pattern, a really cool red color. And it flowers easily, and it flowers underwater, and it forms a seed pod underwater, and it can self-pollinate and make really cool little baby red plants. The reason for the shout out and the reason I'm calling Amy out on calling red plants overrated is because Esther Mouse at Aquaflora has one of the tanks in her showroom that's probably a 48 by 24. I don't know specifically.
Yeah.
That is just solid Barclaya longifolia. And it's incredible. It is stunning display.
Jinx.
Jinx. It's an amazing, amazing plant. This is not a super demanding plant. Good light and CO2, and it will get even redder and grow better. But I originally grew this plant in a low-tech tank. It was probably 12 years ago or longer, so I don't even remember what substrate it was. It would have been high-output T5 lighting because that was the thing back then. It could have been a dirt tank. I bet it was a dirt tank.
Yeah. Here's the thing about Barclaya. We've had two tiny little plants for a little bit now. We got them before we moved, and it was when we were starting to transition towards that, and they got put. They got put in a tank they shouldn't have been in with, like, almost no light, with other random plants in there, with gravel substrate and no fertilization, and we still have them. They were probably an inch when they went in, and now they're growing for us because we moved and moved them where they should be.
Yeah.
Hardy.
Hardy. Yep.
Now, I was going to comment, I don't think this is meant to diminish how beautiful this plant is, but this is where I'm going to step in and say, I think this is a great testament to how sometimes just leaning into one thing in a tank just really makes it work. Like that tank we have downstairs, all that's in it is Glosso and it looks great.
Yeah.
Or like people are like, oh, I want 6 neon tetras and 6 of that. And I'm like, or you could put in like 20 cardinal tetras and the tank will look way better.
Stunning.
Yeah. It's the impact of like having all of that bright red hit you at once.
Right.
Or the neon color of a cardinal tetra. That wall of neon hitting you is...
Yeah. When you start mixing and matching, you dilute everyone's color in it because there's too much happening.
Yeah. You lose the impact. I know which tank you're talking about. And look up Esther Mouse. She's on Instagram. She's got a bunch of really cool projects that she's working on.
And she's awesome.
She's very cool.
Yep. So there we go. I just kind of jumped into it. I have to admit, when I made my initial top 5 list, I forgot to put that on there until Amy started like ragging on the red plant thing. And I'm like, okay, you know what? I'm putting it in.
Yeah, fair
That's
enough.
It. There's
fair
my
enough.
First plant.
Yeah.
There we go. I went first.
All right. Well, I'll transition from that because I would like to talk about Epanogetes. Does Barclaya have a tuber or is it just roots?
It's fairly tuberous-like.
Okay. But it doesn't have like the big bulb that an Epanogeton has.
It's got a bit of a bulb.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the Epanogeton that I chose is Ovaceous because I think that it's gorgeous and it's got that nice bright green color, which apparently I'm going to talk about a lot today.
I just have to interject very briefly. Don't worry, I'm not taking either of you. I actually put on my list the genus Epanogeton, except Madagascarensis, because Madagascarensis deserves all the credit it gets and gets a lot of credit. So it's not overrated. So I put on my list the genus Epanogeton. So,
yeah, I thought about doing that, but Ulvaceous, I think, is my favorite one. And I actually found some nice trivia about it. It is called Ulvaceous after the genus of marine algae, Ulva, which a lot of people use as foods. Yeah, it looks just like it. So
it totally does.
Yeah, mind blown.
Right.
See, Charles probably even knows that because it's used as food for a lot of veggie reef fish.
Well, that and it's like, you know, delicious.
Is it?
Yeah.
Do people eat it too?
Yeah.
Oh, I know more about feeding fish than feeding myself. So.
The algae, not the Epanogeton.
Right.
I don't know if people eat Epanogetons. They might.
Maybe they should.
The algae. Yeah.
Anyway, that
We're
was...
We're not endorsing. We have no FDA qualifications to endorse whether or not you should or should eat Epanogetons. Please don't.
The other fun trivia about Epanogeton ulvaceous that I read in Crystal Castleman's book is there is a live-bearing variation of Epanogeton ulvaceous.
A live-bearing variation?
Mm-hmm.
Wait, explain that.
Yeah, I did not know what that meant, so I looked it up, and it means that the flowers, instead of producing seeds, produce bulbs and little teeny plants.
The flowers do?
Yeah, that's what it said. I don't know.
Wow.
I need to look more into that because I did not know that that was a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, this is why I don't like plants. They're too weird.
Plants break all the rules.
Yeah, but you like
Moena. Yeah, I do.
Anyway, back to just Epanogetons in general. I think they're a great experiment for people who want to dip their toes into a little bit more complex sides of the planted aquarium hobby. They're hardy so that they can take it.
Yeah.
But if you want to learn things like dormancy and growing plants from seeds and flowers, Epanogetons are such a good test subject for all of that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And we've had Ulvaceous drop seeds and pop up with new plants in our sales tanks here. So they're more ready to do that than you'd think. They generally require or rely on continuous growth. So you do have to work to get the kind of growth you want out of them in fertilization or really good substrate. But if you don't give them that, they will just not grow that well until you do. Generally speaking.
Right. I have... So one of the things I love about all the Epanogetons is that they do flower and they do go to seed.
Yeah.
And so in our local aquarium club, I have reached the level of master aquatic gardener or master horticulturist. There we go. That's what the level is. Grandmaster horticulturist. Mm. That's where I'm in. To get that, I had to get 5 different plants to produce offspring from seed. 2 of them were Epanogetans. 1 of them was Epanogeton oleaceus.
I believe it.
Because it's not a difficult one to do.
No.
Yeah, they're amazing. And to get any plant to flower in your aquarium, it always makes you smile.
Yeah. And it feels like an achievement because it's not that common.
Yeah, yeah.
It is an achievement.
Epanogetans are going to put out these really cool little flower spikes that are going to stick up above the water surface. Mm-hmm. They are super easy to pollinate. Take one of those paintbrushes from one of those kids' paintbrushes sets. And just as soon as you see the flower, okay, so we got to look up this, whether... I'm backing up here a little bit. Epanogetans come under 2 categories, self-pollinators and non-self-pollinators. I believe oleaceus is a self-pollinator.
I actually did not catch that.
Okay. I think it's the Epanogetans that are native to Madagascar that are not self-pollinators, and the other ones are self-pollinators. Like, there's a really amazing, weird distinction.
Oleaceus is a Madagascar native, so maybe it isn't.
So then maybe it's the opposite. Yeah. Maybe Madagascar are self-pollinators. We need to find that out.
I know.
We'll get back to you on that. We got Crystal's book right here, so I know we can figure out exactly what's going to happen there. Anyway, if it is a self-pollinator, then it's got to be because we had them do it here.
ULVA.
So they've got to be a self-pollinator. Unless we had 2 flowers.
We had a whole big batch of plants that came in at once, and I think... It was either after we had sold them or when we got to the end of them, we noticed all these little shoots popping up from them. Right. So I really don't know.
Could be both ways.
And okay, a lot of the times they come in already flowering because of the way that they're grown out there.
And then they could have already pollinated.
Yeah, it could have been.
So if they are self-pollinating, 1 flower spike comes up, take the kid's paintbrush. Every day you see the flower open, just brush it. And what you're doing is you're spreading pollen. What are the technical terms?
Pollen?
Wait, you're talking about stamen and...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think the stamen is where you're trying to get the pollen to go.
Okay. So you're pushing the pollen to the stamen with that little paintbrush. If they're self-pollinating, they don't have a rejection method in the flower to take their own genetic material. If they are not self-pollinating, you just need to have 2 of them grow near each other. And then you brush each of them with the same paintbrush. So what you're doing is you're spreading the pollen just like a bee would do from one of the flowers to the other. That is the method. And I don't remember with the oleaceus when I did that, if there were 2 or 1. So you need, if it is not self-pollinating, you need to have 2 plants flowering at the same time. If they are self-pollinating, you only need 1.
Yeah, and... Oh, you need 2 of them or 5 of them or 10 of them.
They're cool enough.
Yeah, you're not losing anything.
Are Epanogetans in any way related to Madagascar lace plants?
Epanogeton madagascarensis? Yes, they're closely related.
Yeah, that is probably the most commonly seen and talked about one because it is really, really distinct.
They're super unique and they're super cool. Yes.
Okay.
Are they
a little bit more... My understanding is that Madagascars are a little bit more finicky than the other Epanogetans.
They are a little bit more touchy.
Okay.
Yeah. There's a lot of variation in collection locations for Madagascar lace plants. So where that touchiness comes from, I think, has something to do with collection location. That is anecdotal evidence, not confirmed.
Because it's from 1803.
Yeah.
And he was telling me that a lot of it has to do with, like, it probably has to do with, like, altitude.
That's one of the very possible explanations. Originally, when we started getting Madagascar lace plants in, we all were told they need to be kept in a cool tank. And there was a lot of success in growing Madagascar lace plants in cool tanks. More recently, we've kept them in tanks of varying temperatures with varying degrees of success, sometimes working, sometimes not. And that makes me think that collection location does have something to do with it. But that's not scientifically confirmed.
Hmm.
What are you guys coming up with?
So The white and yellow flowered forms, cross-pollination is required, essential, and the violet form is self-fertile.
All right.
So...
Of Aponogeton elvaceous?
Of elvaceous, I'm sorry.
Of elvaceous specifically.
Elvaceous specifically. Apparently, it depends.
It depends.
Which,
there we go.
That's like such a typical Aponogeton thing, right? Like, it depends. You get this one from there, that one from there. They're very specific and very interesting to try and grow.
I love it.
Yeah. So that's great.
If we know, we should start designating when we know the color of the flower of the Aponogeton elvaceous that we're selling.
Yeah, because I think it's similar for Madagascar lace, not necessarily pollination, but temperature or the temperature or altitude.
Yeah.
Because there are white flower Madagascar lace and purple flower Madagascar lace.
Ooh, we need to do more delving. We need our scientific.
This is why they're underrated. Because they just beg this kind of nitpicking.
We get to make Charles learn about plants.
Like, you can grow them without knowing any of this stuff.
Yeah.
But if you want to get into Aponogetons, there's like so much nerdy stuff to get into.
I love it.
Yeah. Okay, Charles.
Amy, that was an excellent choice. So we made Charles, in all fairness, we do like to pick on Charles with, it's not that he hates plants. It's just he likes fish. So they're not what he cares about the most.
Yeah.
So I'm really curious to see what plants Charles is going to come up with as his most underrated aquarium plants.
Hold on. Okay.
I was telling Amy the other day, I was sorely tempted to put hair algae on this list.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, I love it.
That is the, like, best fry feeder I have ever had in any of my tanks. I maintain a little clump of it in my fry tanks just because it has so much of a biofilm on it that the fry can, like, eat it. I did not do that because I told myself,
it's not a plant.
It's not a plant. So I was like, you can't do that. That's cheating.
Also, shrimp tanks. Gotta have hair algae almost.
Oh, yeah.
So I put...
Shrimp propagation tanks. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There we go. So as my first reveal, I put down Crypt lucens.
Oh, that's a great one.
Yeah. Why?
So I really like... This is all Amy's fault, by the way. I never kept any rooting plant before I started working here. And then Amy convinced me to start working with crypts. So all of the rooted plants in any of my tanks are a species of crypt. Crypt lucens.
Crypt addiction.
Is the one I like when I want that certain region to be clumped together and like kind of dense.
They do that very well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So typical crypt growing conditions, and yes, there's one of the few groups of plants that we can say typical.
Yeah.
Not too demanding on the slower growing side. A low-tech tank is just fine, I think, for pretty much all the crypts. I can't think of anything that's going to demand a high-tech tank.
The most demanding plants in my tanks are my crypt lucens, and all I do for them is every like other month or so I stick in a flourish tap.
Yeah. There are some crypts that will want specific water conditions like acidity.
Yeah, that's true.
But there aren't many that I know that require high light or CO2.
Yeah, my tanks are definitely neither of those.
Neither of those. Yeah.
Other than the few like immersed crypts that might, you know, that are naturally immersed in the wild.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But those you're not likely to see in aquariums anyway.
But I'll also throw out there that a lot of my favorite fish to work with, bettas, are from Southeast Asia, and crypts are ubiquitous in that region of the world.
Definitely.
That's a great point.
I'm not so much of a stickler for I need this specific plant from this part of Borneo, but if I'm like, it's a Bornean crypt, I'll accept it. Like,
there's something fun to just having things in your tank that are from the same place.
Yeah.
Even if that's not specifically what you're going for.
That's an excellent choice. And I think
a
slightly narrower leaf than a crypt wint dye.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much a decent, good, dark green color.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Easy growing, a little taller than wint dye, typically, although wint dye can get tall depending on the conditions.
And a little more compact growing, too. So an alternative, not a replacement.
Yes, I like it. Yeah.
Cool.
That's a good choice. And readily available. Belong in lots of planter tanks.
Yeah, and I almost never sell them. We almost always have them in the store.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I might have sold like two in the last few months.
People know Wentai.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. for sure. I like it. I'm gonna stick with the crypt theme.
All right, I can do that.
Yeah. Oh, there's three of them that I had a hard time choosing as to which crypt would be the coolest, underrated. So I'm gonna go with one that has a fun story. No, I'm not doing that one.
You know, I had somebody ask me about that.
You did?
About your joke.
Sweet.
Yeah. They. I don't want to tell you, but they thought it was funny.
Yes. See?
Yeah. Watch the YouTube video if you haven't seen the joke of our most recent plant unboxing. I think that was the early August one.
I love it. No, actually, I'm talking about Cryptopanagidifolia.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. So...
It just basically may as well be an Aponogeton crypt.
Exactly. Right. It's a crypt that looks like an Aponogeton, and it looks very similar to Aponogeton boivinianus. It's less demanding than an Aponogeton.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't go through any kind of a dormancy phase like an Aponogeton. It's really nice and big and tall and has crinkly leaves, and I like crinkly leaves.
This sounds like a plant I might like.
It's beautiful.
They're awesome.
Have you seen Ben's home tank?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's featured in there, and it's gorgeous.
Oh, so
yeah.
Sorry, someone's holding up the book with a picture of it.
Right.
Oh.
And so I got my Cryptopanagidifolia from a good friend, from an icon in the aquarium club scene. His name's Charlie Grimes, and Charlie has been... He does one of the only comedic aquarium talks that I know. It's called the Dead Fish Talk.
Oh
no.
And yes, he shows a lot of pictures of dead fish. There's a dead fish. There's another dead fish. I had that fish and that one died.
It's horrible.
It's hilarious.
Yeah.
I had the pleasure.
Only to a real fish keeper is that.
Oh
hilarious?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a funny talk. We know that happens in the hobby. We, mm-hmm. we kill fish. And Charlie Grimes has probably bred something like 700 different species of fish.
Wow.
He has been in the hobby for something like 1,100 years. And, okay, Charlie, sorry, that was a little, maybe that was a little much.
A little less than generous.
Right. He has been in the hobby for 50 plus years for sure. And doing this talk, I think I've heard the talk four times at three different aquarium clubs. It's a great talk, and you do actually learn something from the talk, but it's comedic. I had the pleasure of going to his home club down in Indiana, the Circle City Aquarium Club, and doing a presentation at their club, and got a tour of Charlie's fish room. And while I was there, he said, if there's anything you want, grab it. And of course, that's just awkward. I'm not going to, you know, grab it. I made some comment about an Aponogeton. Because even me, when you look at that plant, your first thought is it's an Aponogeton. He said, that's not an Aponogeton. I said, that's Cryptopanagidifolia? He said, yeah, take some. So he gave me two really nice, big, beautiful Aponogidifolias. They are in my one home tank. And they are beautiful and they are multiplying. They are a slow-growing crypt plant. Eventually, they'll multiply enough that I'll be able to bring some into the store.
Mm-hmm.
If I do ever see some of them on the list, we will get a lot of them in because they're really cool.
They don't show up very often, but they are so hardy that they last forever.
They do, yeah. He has had that population. I think he said, I got those like 23 years ago and so-and-so. And he rattled off the name of somebody, a name I recognized. So shout out to Charlie. Charlie's a great guy, a really cool aquarium keeper, has been doing it for a long time. He has forgotten more things than most of us know. He'd be the first to say that, because he forgets a lot of stuff.
That's amazing.
He likes to make those kinds of jokes. He gave me Cryptopanagidifolia. If you find that plant, get some. It's really a really cool, thick, crinkly-leaved background plant.
Yeah, beautiful.
Yep.
Should I share my crypt then? Because I have one too.
Yep.
I put Ponditurifolia down.
Just because of the name and no one can pronounce it.
It is a tricky one to pronounce, but because it's a really unique leaf shape for a crypt, it's got those broader, flatter leaves, still slow growing. It is a crypt, but also still very hardy.
Mm-hmm.
It provides really great cover for fish that like to stay low. Hiding places for females if you need that type of thing.
It's almost like the hosta of crypts.
Yeah, it is a lot like that. Yeah. It kind of beautiful broad leaves, pointed and rounded at the bases. They can get a little, some variants can get actually quite red, but the most common is green.
I love red.
And under enough light, even the typical one that you'll see that's green will get a little bit of red. I'm seeing that now in my twin star tank. But yeah, just same thing that we've said about all the crypts. This one is just a little bit different, and we don't sell that much of it. And I think it's a shame.
Seems like almost something that should be used as a mid-ground hedge.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of uses for it.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if people don't buy it because it's so hard to pronounce.
Could be. Nobody wants to ask for it.
Pontederafolia. I think it's if you phonetically pronounce it out.
Pontifolia.
Right. Just say it fast and you're fine.
That works for most scientific names, by the way. People will get what you're saying. Nobody says them right anyway. Well, I mean, we've avoided saying Cryptocurrina, so.
I was about to say, like, I think the technical way to pronounce it is Wentii.
Yeah.
But everyone says Wentii, whatever. Right. And I'm like, everyone knows what you mean when you say it. Like, who cares?
If you ever want the funniest one to look up, there's a swordtail out of Mexico. They're all out of Mexico. But the common name is Nezi swords. It's a Xiphophora species. Just look it up. Maybe at the end of the broadcast, I'll actually say how to pronounce it. But Nezi swords. Just look up those guys.
Okay.
Pontederafolia, excellent choice. Mm-hmm. I love it.
Yeah, not much more to say about it, but just give it a shot.
Every time Amy's done and Charles is going to be next, I just can't wait to hear what he's going to come up with.
So for my next one, I put down any species of Anubias.
Other than Barteria, I assume.
Even Barteria. Because, like, that's a plant that I actually am like, bro, it's so easy. Like, I stole some from another tank downstairs and put it in and with my Betahendra.
Yeah.
Because I know it can handle basically anything. And I can almost never get someone to buy an Anubias. And we keep a couple different species in.
We keep a couple different cultivars.
That's true.
Right.
And a couple different species.
I guess we do have a couple different species. But Anubias barteri is the main species. There's variation Nana, variation barteri, Coffifolia, Nana Petite. There's one more.
Is it the Lancelata?
No, that's a long leaf. That's
specifically a species.
Oh, awesome.
I know some people nowadays, Anubias pinto is a barteri that just has that variegation virus.
Right.
I know we have some, I think it's pronounced Azephalia.
F. zeli is actually a congensis variant. So the longer pointed leaves versus pretty much any round leafed Anubias that you see is a barteri variant.
Right. Okay.
And actually, you're right. Cultivar is a misnomer because many of them are naturally occurring, and a cultivar is technically cultivated. So it would be a variant, not a cultivar.
Yes.
Plant taxonomy is weird.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, great point. I love them because they are so stupidly durable.
One of my jokes around here is that they're easier than plastic plants.
True.
Yeah.
You don't have to clean them.
I tell people that, like, I have friends who maintain tanks that they switched from plastic plants to Anubias for that very reason. And they have kept their tanks that way for like 10 years at this point.
Yeah.
It works and it's easy. They are painfully slow growing, but they take up nutrients that normally would turn into algae and grow on plastic plants. Not that there's not going to be any algae growth on an Anubias leaf, because that can happen and does happen, but you dramatically reduce the likelihood and you increase the water quality. I've even seen Anubias plants with African cichlids.
I believe it.
And goldfish. They're tough, hardy, thick leaves that a lot of fish have a hard time eating, and it works.
Like the filamentosa barbs we have downstairs, they eat basically any soft plant. Like, they devour hair algae like it's nothing.
Yeah, you can throw a golf ball in there and it'll be gone by the end of the day.
Right.
But you can put Anubias in there and they're like,
not worth it.
Maybe we'll clean it a little bit.
They're like, that's a lot of work.
Yeah, the only thing, like the only difficulty I see ever people have with Anubias is just potassium deficiency, and it's just because it's easier to see in a slow-growing plant.
Right. If your leaves are turning yellow, add potassium.
Yeah.
That's it. With Anubias plants, other leaves turning yellow could be different things, but with Anubias plant, that's it.
And I think you're right to say all Anubias, because, yeah, we see Bartrii a lot, but Anubias hostifolia, Anubias afzelii, Anubias fraseri, those are all beautiful, fantastic plants that are just as easy to grow as the more common Anubias.
Yeah, and they come in different shapes. So, like, if you want different, quote-unquote, textures or whatever in your tank, you can pull that off. Like, you could theoretically do an entire aquascape with nothing but Anubias, and it wouldn't look like it's one plant.
Yeah, and no soil.
Yeah.
They're all apophytes.
Yeah.
No soil, and you might not even need fertilization as long as you do decent water changes and have a fish load in there.
And keep a lower light.
Yeah.
Yeah. That slow growth, the nutrient load from the fish will keep up if the light's low enough. And it would be so easy.
Yeah, it would be so easy. That's basically what I'm doing in my shrimp tank right now. Fantastic.
Anybody that has plastic plants should throw them all away and buy Anubias. I can't think of any fish that's really going to devour Anubias. Silver dollars will still eat Anubias.
Yeah. Well,
they're like bulldozers.
So just about anybody who has plastic plants. Although, actually, I've seen silver dollars eat plastic plants, too.
Like I said, they're bulldozers. They are so...
How about throw away your plastic plants and get some driftwood or something?
Yeah, there we go.
And I'm just going to harp on that a little bit because I think that's an option that a lot of people don't think about. Most fish habitats that like we commonly keep in tanks, they don't come from heavily planted environments. They come from driftwood flows and or rocky reefs. And I'm like, it's okay to replicate that. You don't need plants if you don't want to work with them, but they do help you. That's why I keep them.
Yeah, any tank that doesn't have fish that eat plants should have plants.
Yeah.
Agreed. The end.
That is 100%. Drop the microphone and walk away.
I will admit, as a person who, quote unquote, doesn't like plants, every one of my freshwater tanks has live plants in it. But we do like to joke, well, it's more accurate to say it's a fish tank with plants, not a planted aquarium.
Yeah.
Yep, that's a good call.
That's great.
All right. Wait, I got to put my glasses on here to see what's next on my list.
It's your fault. You wrote it on a tiny post-it note.
I was in a hurry. I'm going to go with Pogostamen helferi.
Ooh.
Yeah. So I like little crinkly leaves for some reason.
Yeah.
I almost put Crinum calumstratum on there, but I decided that that's not underrated enough.
No. Everyone who knows what it is loves it.
Exactly. Yes. But Pogostamen helferi almost looks like little miniature Crinum calumstratums.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I have not had the privilege of growing it yet, so you're going to have to talk about it.
Definitely a more challenging plant. They want the temperature in the more 74 to 76, 74, 72. Like, they can handle up to 76. So you do need to pay attention to what fish you're putting in with that plant. The fish that absolutely require the 78 degrees and higher are not going to be a good combination with Pogostamen helferi.
Okay.
They are going to require higher light. They are going to really want CO2. They're not going to require it. You can get them to do okay without CO2. But really, it's a high-tech tank, a high-tech planet aquarium plant.
Which we've been talking about is not as intimidating as it should seem.
No.
High-tech may mean high growth, but it doesn't always mean high maintenance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good way to say it. I think they do a really cool job of growing like in between rocks and stuff. They're borderline an epiphyte. But rock walls are a great way to grow Pogostamen helferi, or in between rocks. Or
sounds like similar growth to like a hygro compacta.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd say that's true.
Okay.
Yep. They don't really need super rich soil, but they are going to want more light and lower temperature and those kind of things. They are going to stay like 2 inches tall. They don't get any height to them at all. And then they're going to spread slowly in these bunches, almost like hens and chickens.
Mm,
you know, in gardens, hens and chickens?
Yeah.
They're going to behave very similar to hens and chickens, only in an aquarium.
Like an aquarium succulent.
It's an aquarium succulent, right? You don't have to water it.
Yeah.
This guy.
anaconda.
I mean, that's the reason I keep planted tanks, okay? And I don't keep house plants. I don't want to have to remember to water things. So that's much
you
more appealing to me.
You remember to do water change, but you don't remember to water your house plants.
I have killed cacti through neglect. So I, this is why I keep planted aquariums.
That almost seems to be done with intent.
Yeah. So it was malicious. It looked at me wrong.
Yeah, they deserved it, is what you're saying. You're all those pokey things looking at you.
Uh-huh.
So two things related to the growing aquatic plants. So my sister is a plant person.
Mm-hmm.
So you notice in a lot of the YouTube videos lately that's been pretty plant focused.
Yeah.
That's because most of those videos are inspired by specific questions she's asked me because she's looking to start her first aquatic planet tank.
Yeah, we got
to
hook her. Like
just because she's like, plants that grow underwater, that's different.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Very cool. All
right, Amy, yeah, great choice.
Wait, before we get to that, is this a plant that would lend itself well to a biotope?
Well, any plant would lend itself well to a biotope if you do a biotope based around where it's growing.
I mean, true, but is this a plant that would be worthwhile to, you were talking about its specific temperature requirements. Was this a plant that you could do like a central biotope around? Like,
So yes, biotope, absolutely. There are India, Myanmar, and Thailand. So there's lots of different ecosystems that they come from. They're going to be more of a moving river than a still water. But
I mean, given the cooler water temperature, that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. And growing like out of rocks in India, Myanmar, and Thailand.
There's a lot of cool things you could do with that.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yep.
Yeah, that's a great one.
Yep.
All right. We talked about crypts, so I'm going to do my alternative to a crypt next, and this is one that we've had fairly often because I bring in my leftovers. But it's the chain sword, Helianthium bolivianum, is actually the species name for both Quadricostatus and Augustifolius, which I did not know until I looked it up.
I feel like I knew that Quadricostatus, and I thought it was Helianthus quadricostatus.
Yeah, it's not. But it's bolivianum, which is not a name I've ever seen it traded under.
I don't think I've ever heard that either.
Yeah, but I looked it up in Crystal's book, and that's what it is.
Yeah.
It's a common plant, and I think it's one that a lot of people know, but I have a really hard time selling. It grows twice as fast as any crypt, if not more.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the same height. It gets about 6 inches tall.
Mm-hmm.
And that plant can carpet a tank like within, I don't know, a couple of months or so pretty easily. Really bright green, really undemanding, doesn't need super high of light. That's just a plant that likes to grow and has that really narrow, kind of similar shape to most swords, but it's not a true sword, not an Echinodorus.
I believe it was for a while in Echinodorus, and it's definitely called pygmy chain sword. Like everybody thinks of it as a sword.
Yeah, but it grows by runners and it grows really quickly and is beautiful.
I like it. Let's get some more.
Yes. Is this, I'll let you know when I have some to bring in.
Quadricostata I've seen on lists lately.
Yeah, it has been.
You can get those.
It has been.
Yep. Are you thinking specifically? So are you saying?
So the true bolivianum, like the main one, has the leaves that I most closely associate with the plant. The quadricostata is actually a little bit thicker leaved.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I believe the one that I have is the bolivianum. The Augustifolius is actually much narrower leaf. That would be like the really fine-leaved variety of it.
So are you saying there's three?
Yeah, there's three, but they all go under the name bolivianum.
I don't think I've ever seen the middle one. I've seen the really skinny one.
Well, maybe.
And I've seen the fat one.
Because I had this revelation today, so maybe you need to look at the book too.
Yeah.
All right, so I looked it up, and I'm going to blow your mind even more.
What?
Because Vesuvius is also the same species.
Vesuvius sword is the same species.
It is the same species as a narrow leaf chain sword. So flip those next couple of pages, and they're all bolivianum in quotes with what we know them as.
Vesuvius swords are kind of cool.
Wow.
See?
Okay, but Tenellum is a different species.
Yeah, I don't know. The one that looks most like what I have is just the first picture, which is that. That looks correct to me.
That's the one that if somebody tried to trade into me, I would say that was Quadricostata.
Yeah, me too. Me too. And
but
that's
when I see
much thicker.
Quadricostata, much wider leaf.
Yeah. Right. And Augustifolias, we never really see, which is, it's beautiful. But so I'm just going to say that species of plant, which has four things which are amazing and I think are all underrated.
Wow. Okay. That Quadricostata and Vesuvius are the same plant.
I don't...
Crystal, you got some explaining to
I
do.
Know,
that's
I
what
don't
I'm saying
get it.
There. So in case anybody's wondering how we're coming up with these crazy epiphanal ideas, it's because we have the most amazing planted aquarium identification and description book sitting in front of us. This would be Planted Aquarium. This would be Aquarium Plants by Crystal Castleman. If you are a planted aquarium person and you don't have this book, get this book.
Yeah, it is a must-have.
It is a must-have.
Can I say your name?
Okay. So Robbie and I reference this book a lot because he and I are both fans of biotopes. And like that information alone, for someone like me, makes this book valuable.
Yeah. Even though Charles is not a planted aquarium person, he still recognizes the value of this amazing book. And so according to Crystal, whom I definitely consider an authority, Amy's little revelation here about Helianthem bolivianum being the same, being the genus, and Quadricostata, Vesuvius, Augustifolia, all being variations of bolivianum, is something I've never heard in the aquarium hobby.
Yeah. And I believe they were all originally described as their own Echinodorus species.
Right.
So maybe they were described as bolivianum and they just haven't been split yet. They're so different.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Now, they are different, but the environmental factors that impact growth form are dramatic in corals and in plants.
Right.
And there's a lot of taxonomic studying being done with corals and plants saying, hey, these two corals that we thought were different have the exact same DNA sequence, but they don't look anything alike.
Yeah.
That gives me a little bit of a hope for...
Yeah, we're going to need to look into this more because it's got to be a genetic study.
This is fascinating.
Yeah.
So,
regardless, just to grow it, narrowleaf chainsword is the common name that you will most often see this traded under, I would say.
Is this the same or different as microsword?
Different.
Microsword is different. But narrowleaf chainsword is usually going to come in as Helianthus tenellus.
You think? I don't know. We've had it as Quadricostata. I don't know. Common names are worthless.
Yeah. Quadricostata we've only gotten recently.
Yeah.
In the past, narrowleaf chainsword has been tenellus. That's like...
Because to me, all that we have gotten in as chainsword at all has been Quadricostata. So, anyway.
it's a really cool plant I'm trying to talk about.
And taxonomy is a mess.
Yes. What were we going to say, Charles?
No, you answered my question already.
Okay.
Go. Wow. Okay. That's all I have to say about that. If you see any chain swords traded, go for it. They're fun.
Yeah. But if it's a scientific name, it's right.
You will still see those traded as Echinodorus often.
Oh, yeah.
And they are just not.
That's something I actually came across the other day where, and this isn't plant, this is fish related.
Mm-hmm.
I had someone asking me about Viejito pistos.
Oh, yeah.
And they were like, why is this Macrostoma labeled as a common name?
McMasteri.
Yeah, sorry. Wow.
Different fish.
McMasteri labeled as with a common name, Viejita.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, because that's what it's sold to us as when most people think of Viejitas, they're thinking of that strain of McMasteri. I don't think I have ever seen a true Viejita in the hobby.
That's very possible.
You were thinking really hard there.
Yeah. You know, I'm going back to some of the epistos that have come through from reliable sources, but then I know where those epistos were originally purchased.
Yeah, and that's one thing that people got to keep in mind is that sometimes it's not scientific names are better, but sometimes they just, people don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. We have to do the best we can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's why I am a big proponent of collection locations. Yeah,
exactly.
Whenever we can.
Exactly. All right, yeah. Charles, that was a big digression. What is your next one?
I put down guppy grass.
Ah, that's a great
one. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you can float around and you can use it for live bears or bubble nesting bettas or whatever.
Most likely, Nejas guadalupensis?
Yes.
Most likely, but we don't know that for sure because that's another one of those that's really confusing.
Yeah, I know it as Nias grass.
Yeah. I think the technical pronunciation should be Nejas grass, but it depends on... Okay, wait. Phonetic, is that probably going to be Greek or Latin? N-A-J-A-S. So in some...
Yeah.
Translations, a J turns into a Y.
With this
phonetically
word, I don't know the entomology of it.
But Guadalupensis is a Latin American word, and then the J would turn into an H.
Well, it's not a Latin American word. It's a Latin American location.
Ooh, right. So
then
it might,
is the genus Greek from a Greek or a Latin root?
If it's named from... This is me being... sorry... To our viewers at home, brace yourself. Well, if it's a Latin American word for a Latin American location, it's probably got a Latin entomology, assuming that this isn't a location name that's named by natives.
No. But the genus, I don't believe, is specific to South America.
Okay.
So then that would mean the genus either comes from the Greek or the Latin.
Yeah. I would have to guess probably Latin, though.
And then the J.
We say as Amy's like actually looking it up, like we're doing nothing but speculate here.
I'm looking it up to the best of my abilities because it's not easy.
Because she has the entomology in there in a lot of the plants.
You guys keep saying entomology. It's etymology.
That's what
entomology
I said. Etymology
is bugs.
I said etymology.
I'm sorry. I can only take 5 instances of that.
5.
It does not have... Oh, it's actually after Greek nymphs.
So it is Greek.
It is Greek.
So yeah. The J would be a Y sound, so Nias is correct.
Yep.
Okay. Wow, so we got there.
Nias Guadalupensis, which is how I always used to pronounce it. I don't know why I went Nejas this time.
It just feels like it feels
Nias.
Like a Hispanic
it's
word.
It's Nias grass.
Yeah.
Yep, it's Nias grass.
Anyways, super easy to take
Described
care of.
Described in 1753.
Whoa. Sorry, I just had to pause and like process that because I was like, 1753, that would be like contemporary to like Linnaeus. Like that's really early.
Yeah, the genus Nias, 1753.
I like it.
Wow. Anyways, super easy to take care of. I honestly wouldn't, myself, I'm not going to give specifics on it because I'm like, I've never had problems with it. So it seems to do fine anywhere I put it.
It needs light.
Just a little bit.
Yeah. It does sometimes have issues with water that's too clean.
Mm.
Too many water changes can make it suffer. But it does such a great job of nutrient uptake that you can do less water changes with a dense amount of Nias grass.
That would explain why it does so well on my fry tanks.
Yeah.
Tanks yeah. You're feeding heavily.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. For sure. Yep. It loves nutrients.
Yeah. And I think underrated as a plant, maybe well rated within the breeding community, but with people who are trying to branch into it.
Yeah. My plants in general, I think they're underappreciated because they're common and like so people just like, oh whatever, it's just like the common isn't cool, and I'm like, but these are so easy to take care of.
Yeah.
Nias grass is really hard to use in an aquascape.
Yeah,
because it grows so fast and just goes everywhere. But there is no better plant for breeding live. The reason it's called guppy grass, right? Breeding live bears, put Nias grass in there.
Yeah,
they'll do better,
and it's not going to be nearly as messy as a hornwort.
Yeah, a lot of the top dwelling killifish using the natural method with a bunch of Nias grass in there, they do great.
10 out of 10.
Yeah, those yep. aphiosemians we have downstairs are definitely into it.
Yes, yes.
Why do you think I put some guppy grass in with them?
But for sure, I can't stress this enough, live bears.
Yeah.
Put them in with live bears.
Absolutely.
Yep. Fun choice. I like it. I knew Charles was going to come up with some really cool ideas. All right. I almost did another crypt, but I need to stay away from the crypts because there's too many.
Which one?
Can I have the book, please?
Oh.
Sorry.
So I'm going with, because I didn't do Crinum calum stratum as much as I love that plant, its larger cousin, Crinum natans.
See, I would have argued Crinum calum stratum is not underrated. This is definitely underrated.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Crinum natans, that's the big boy downstairs,
yeah.
right?
Oh, yeah. Medusa. Oh, yeah.
Yes. So Crinum calum stratum Crinum natans is an easy growing bulb plant. It's actually in the onion family. Yes, related to those ones we like to eat. In fact, I do believe natans is edible. We're not going to find out. Please don't, unless you look into it more than I have.
Mm.
But it's very similar to calum stratum, but it's got a much wider leaf. The leaf is close to an inch wide. It's got that really cool crinkly effect that I really like a lot, like Pocasang would help with. The one that we have in the shop, the leaves are probably a little over 6 feet long.
Yeah.
They do an immersed flower. It is an absolutely gorgeous. It's almost 5 inches wide.
Yeah, and it smells amazing.
It's really cool.
It actually ended up producing in that same time period, like 4 of them.
Yeah.
It was amazing. It was a fantastic experience.
Yep. The challenge with getting those things to bloom is that it's got to be a mature plant. And I think that plant was probably close to 4 or 5 years old before it flowered for the first time.
Wow.
And it's huge. It is not for the little nano tank. It's probably not for a beautifully aquascaped tank. But if you want a big, huge, beautiful, really cool,
amazing
plant.
And as a centerpiece, it's amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Like the older style, like jungle, or I think the Wallstead is the actual term for aquariums. It'd be great for that.
Yes. If you look some pictures on our website, you can see some pictures of our front tank that has it. And on our Facebook page, we've got pictures of that giant tank in there. Somewhere there's a picture of me holding that plant up by its roots before we put it into the tank, and its leaves touch the ground.
And that was after a period of, we grew it in a 4-foot tank for a long time with barely any light, and it just took it.
It was fine. And it kind of went into a state where it didn't grow much, but it's just like, I'll just wait here until you give me the conditions I want.
And when we moved it, it started growing again.
Yeah. And it's flowered here at the store more than once.
Yeah. Monster fish are overrated. Monster plants... way
Ooh,
underrated.
That's a thing.
It is a thing. And it's so worth doing.
It's monsterplants.com.
Because like something like that is so impactful and so cool.
Yeah, it's such a huge, cool plant.
I hate to admit that you're right, but...
yeah.
There we go. That's my next one.
That was a great choice. All right. So... I
was really hoping Amy was going to say, that was a great choice, but mine's better.
No, it's really not. But my next one is a nice plant that I think just kind of goes under the radar, and that's the rosette sword.
Mm, yeah.
Okay.
A lot of the big swords get a lot of the attention, and I'm going to call Amazon sword one of the big swords. Rosettes don't get much more than 6 inches, and they look so similar to an Amazon sword. So they are the monster plant for the nano tank. people want to jam these Amazon swords into 10-gallon tanks. And yeah, they work. And maybe they won't get that huge. But they're going to grow and dominate your tank. And if you like the look of a sword, one of the smaller ones might be a better choice for you.
That's an excellent choice.
Yeah. And they just seem underrated because I don't think people really know that about them.
Yeah.
Or know that the big ones get really, really big.
Some of those swords can get 18, 24, 36 inches long.
That one that we have growing out of the 75?
Oh, it's...
it's an ocelot, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's ocelot. But even Miroguensis, which I thought about choosing, which is a narrower leafed sword with a little bit of darker leaves, that's, when we put it in a big tank, it's still got 18 inches tall. And rosettes... 6 to 10 maybe. So
that makes them very cool.
Yeah.
Beautiful broad leaf. Mm-hmm. Like Amy said, they look a lot like an Amazon
toad. They really do. Yeah. Just smaller.
Right.
So better choice for you if you have a nano tank.
Growing conditions?
Same as most swords, they're going to want really rich substrate or root fertilizations, but other than that, not going to be too picky about light. Doesn't need super high. Low to medium is usually fine. They take up a lot of nutrients just like any sword. So root fertilization and maybe some water column fertilization from time to time too is pretty essential. But other than that, they're not going to be too picky.
I like it. We need more of those. Do we have some right now?
Yeah. Perfect. Yeah, I try to always keep them in stock, even though nobody wants them.
Well,
because I
maybe
think they should.
We should change their mind.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
So,
all right, Charles, back to you.
I think this will be the coolest one I've said because I grabbed the book because this is a plant I liked enough that I looked it up in here. And Crystal told me that everything I thought I knew about this plant was wrong. So, my second to last pick is bogger moss.
Bogger moss?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
So, what we think is Java moss is not actually Java moss.
I knew that.
Yeah. If yes. you think you know about moss, don't read that book because it will tell you you know nothing.
So, the true Java moss, and this is why I grabbed the book, is Taxophyllum dubiana. But what we have ubiquitously in the hobby is apparently Taxophyllum barbarei.
Right.
And I'm like, okay.
So why does the common name matter?
I think it matters here only because Java moss comes from Java.
That's it. But and the Java moss we have in the hobby does not come from Java.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know. Fun fact.
I like barber moss as a name. That's cute. You got to trim it. You got to keep it all.
Right. Like Ken's beard.
All tight. Yeah, exactly. we have a tank that is affectionately known as Ken's beard because it's a very mossy tank.
We also have one of our favorite plant employees who has a beard that looks like it should be trimmed. So that's where the Ken's beard joke comes from.
It's perfect. Right, it's amazing.
So, you know, grows exactly like everyone thinks Java moss does. but I did want to shout out Crystal because I was like, I know I haven't read this book cover to cover, but that's by far the coolest snippet of anything this book has given me so far. I was like, wow, that's like one of my staples, and I didn't even know that.
Yeah, there are so many of those common plants that you realize you don't know anything about once you actually start looking into the history of them.
Right.
So, I use it for basically any of my egg scatterers. I like it a little bit more than spawning mops. Not that there's anything wrong with the spawning mop, but the live plants have the benefit of that biofilm,
right,
where the little fry can harvest or browse.
You think you're saying to say browse, graze.
Yeah. Browse, graze, whatever you want to do. And I, especially for some of the smaller species, I feel like having live plants really helps get them through those first few days where they're just small enough to not take baby brine shrimp.
There are many of the egg scatterers and even mop spawning fish that if you set up a tank with a big thick layer of barber moss or the moss of choice and you put the adults in that tank, keep them in there for 2 weeks and then move them out, the fry will grow to the size where they can take crushed flake food just in that tank.
Yeah.
With very, very little effort.
I raised like 5 generations of cherry barbs with that strategy.
Perfect.
So
yeah.
I will always have a soft spot for barber moss.
Yeah, there's everybody needs to have Java. Sorry. Barber moss.
It's so hard not to. I mean, what are we going to do? Change all of our Java moss to a different name that nobody knows?
Apparently.
You know, we're doing that with bettas.
That's a fair point.
Right. By the way, one of our little pet peeves around here, we don't let people get away with saying beta fish.
It's beta, guys. It's beta. Beta.
It's not Greek.
You guys promised me we could talk about plants today.
Sorry. Okay, back to plants.
I don't have a lot to say on it other than It's amazing. It's super simple. You'll occasionally, it's, at least in the conditions I grow it, it's prone to bouts of hair algae. Mm-hmm. But I'm probably not growing it in the ideal conditions.
Well, and that hair algae is going to benefit you with the fry. So who cares if you get them?
I don't care. So yeah. I actually enjoy that.
I have grown it in 2.5 gallon tanks with just a little bit of light and gotten it nice and thick enough that it outcompeted all other anything that was in the tank. It even outcompeted duckweed.
Wow.
Whoa. Oh, yeah. Now, if you could imagine...
That is a feat.
a 2.5 gallon tank so full of barber moss that you could pull it out and it probably would stay relatively square.
It's a brick.
It's a brick. Yes. But I got lots of baby clown killies. I'm sorry. I got lots of really good effects from the plants. Because we're not talking about fish right now. We're talking about plants.
That's a plant that I feel like people should be trying to trade in here more.
Yeah.
Because that's a plant that I always feel like we could use more of.
Any mosses, right. Honestly. Yeah. They all grow, well, I should say, all the taxophyllum tend to grow pretty similarly as easy.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, yeah. I picked this one mostly just because it's Asian. Most of the fish that I'm breeding it with are Asian. So I like that, you know, correlation yeah. there. But yeah.
I think its commonness makes it underrated. Yeah. Like, people don't appreciate how easy it is.
Or like, but just another fun fact that I picked up from that is people will be like, what's the difference between Christmas moss and barber moss? And I'm like, well, the technical distinction is the leaflet growth pattern, but in practical terms, one comes from Brazil, the other one comes from Asia.
Yeah. And show me them both side to side, and I'm going to shrug at you and walk away.
Yeah, sometimes it's really obvious which one's Christmas moss because it gets that little triangular growth pattern.
Right.
But sometimes Christmas moss doesn't get that triangular growth pattern. It just grows all willy-nilly over the place like barber moss.
Yeah, especially if you're growing it just in a clump.
Yeah.
Like, it's so hard to tell.
Right. And... I feel the need just for anyone reading the book. We are, the common name listed in the book is bogger moss, but we're saying barber because the scientific name is barberi.
Oh, bogger.
Yeah. And
like B-O-G-G-E-R, like frogger with a B?
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
And I'm like, huh. But I think barber makes more sense because it's taxophyllum barberi.
Yeah. I wonder where that common name does come from. Good
we'll
choice.
Find out. I like it. Well, I know we've been picking on crypts a lot, but I'm still going to another crypt.
It's hard to avoid them.
I almost put two on my list, yeah. But I told myself, you already put one in. Just pick something else.
There were three or four that I was considering for this.
So I'm very happy to see everyone else have a plethora of crypts on their list.
I couldn't help myself. Cryptosporidiana. Mm. It's such a cool crypt plant. It's one of the only aquarium plants. It's the only crypt plant I know that's going to flower underwater, and it's going to flower underwater fairly easily. It's just as easy as all of the other crypts. It's got a little brighter green to the leaf with a little hint of pinkish red in it, and I like pinkish red plants.
Yeah.
Yep. But the flower, to me, Cryptosporidiana is so cool. It's a big plant, but it flowers underwater.
That's amazing.
I love that.
It feels bizarre to me that you could say that about a mm-hmm. crypt. Mm-hmm.
And technically, you'd have to say it's an inflorescence because it's a spath, not a flower. And there's a technical distinction there.
Oh, boy.
We're allowed to talk about that, Amy. Yeah. We're talking about plants.
Yeah. So, wait. How does that work? Like, flowering, quote unquote, you said it's technically not a flower, but right. How does that work underwater? Because, like, my understanding is flowers are adaptation to pollinating via air transmission.
As far as I know, it doesn't pollinate when it flowers underwater. I don't believe it will successfully pollinate.
Hmm.
I think it does have to be immersed to actually pollinate.
But it will flower underwater.
But it will still produce flowers underwater. Like an Anubias. Lots of Anubias plants will flower underwater too, but they probably won't pollinate.
So okay. Is that the difference between inflorescence and flowering? Is that one is underwater?
No.
What is the difference
because
then?
Because all crypts produce a spath, not a flower. I don't know what it is.
I don't know what it is.
We're going to have to read that and re-record this whole video just because you asked that question. Or podcast because you asked that question.
Ugh.
But no, there is a technical difference. They are, I believe.
I see both words, and yes. I always thought they were almost interchangeable.
Inflorescence versus... An inflorescence is a spathe or a flower, and there's a difference in it.
Okay. We'll need to really settle in on that.
I just have a professor that if he ever listens to this podcast, he's going, because he's a plant morphologist.
Oh, he's going to.
He's going to be dying inside.
Well, once you start talking about trade names or common names, and I think that plant biologists are going to start crying.
Right. Well,
Jack in the Pulpits.
I know he taught me this distinction, and I know I don't remember it.
Right.
Aw.
Right. So Jack in the Pulpits and pitcher plants, those are spathes.
Like the pitcher part of a pitcher plant, you mean? Okay.
That's the inflorescence of a pitcher plant.
And is that's the group name of it. They're all inflorescences, but different varieties or different ways to do it?
I think so.
Maybe.
Crystal, where are you? We need you.
I know.
Yeah.
I know. If she or Karen were here, they'd like smack us over the head with something.
All
I don't
right,
know.
So here's what we're saying. In 1 week from the release of this podcast, we will have a YouTube video explaining what an inflorescence is.
Yeah.
A spath and a flower.
Yeah. That's a great idea.
Yep.
We should definitely do that.
Yep.
Okay. That was a great choice. I really like that crypt.
Maybe even less than a week. Like the day this is released, also release that video. That we haven't recorded yet, but we will.
I also want to know it.
Exactly.
I'll get out the diagram board.
Wisteriana was a great pick, though.
Thanks,
we do have that here.
We do.
Yeah.
And I love it. I also have that one. That's another one that I have in my tank at home.
Cool. Very cool. All right. My last one was one that I also got some really good new information on when I went to look it up. See, these are all plants that we know and love, but you don't always look into them.
Yeah.
So Nymphoides cristata, species Taiwan.
Oh,
yeah,
because
it does have
choice.
It is actually described because they did a genetic study on it, and it's native to a few different areas.
Yeah.
So Taiwan was linked to the actual cristata population. So this is a lily species, mm-hmm. an Nymphoides. One of the more amazing ones to me. This plant can pretty much propagate by any piece of it you trim off.
Yeah, how about a lily that propagates from cuttings?
Yeah, from cuttings and from runners a little bit too. But like you can trim, and I did this the other day when I was trimming mine. I had to trim one right beneath the leaf, and I had to trim another one at the base. And I left them floating in there for a while, and I pulled them both out. One of them had roots at the end of the stem, and one had roots at the end of the leaf.
That's awesome.
How does it do that? I don't know, but they're so easy to grow. They're so easy to propagate. Most lilies have those big, clunky bulbs that you have to either peel the babies off of, or mm-hmm. they might pop off on their own. This one just wants to grow, and it will grow with anything you give it. Great bright green, does not produce the surface leaves that are going to block out your light. Great underrated plant. I think that some people just lump it in with all lilies, but it is very unique to itself.
It's very unique. Do you know my story about that one?
I don't know that I do.
Right. So, in 2008, I attended the National Convention of the Aquatic Gardeners Association in Atlanta, Georgia. And I had never heard of this plant before that convention. At those big, huge aquarium conventions, the last day is always a big, huge auction. And while we're there, a bunch of the people from the Atlanta Aquarium Club, the host club for the convention, were talking about, at that time, what was known as Nymphoides species Taiwan.
And I think it's still mainly known as that. I did not have a species name until I looked it up.
It was only, I think it was 2014 that it was finally described, maybe even later than that. And we're all looking around like, well, okay, so the guy that I was there with and I were talking about like, wow, what is this plant? I don't know this plant. This is a really cool plant. And it got to auction day and we're like, hopefully it's some of these Nymphoides species that are going to show up. And, they came up for auction and we immediately threw our hands in the air. And one of the people that we met at the convention quick tapped us on the shoulder and she hands me a bag. Don't buy it. I've got plenty of it. What? So I was talking to her about this plant, and she said, yeah, at our aquarium club, it like goes for $1 because everybody has it because it's so easy to propagate. Everybody has it. I'm like, what? I've never heard of this plant. So at that convention, we got that plant and brought it back to Grand Rapids. That was in 2008. Up until 2014, I could trace every Nymphoides species Taiwan that was in West Michigan to that plant.
That's amazing.
We propagated that plant. We sold that plant. It is so easy to propagate.
Yeah.
We sold it at auctions. We sold it through the shop. Every single one of them, I could trace back to that one plant we bought back from Georgia.
It's really prolific.
They're sweet.
But they don't grow so fast you can't keep up with them. Right. There's some of those plants which are like, they just keep growing and I just keep having to give them away.
Yeah, like nice grass.
Yeah, exactly. Like some of those ones that Charles are talking about, when you're growing them in an actual planted tank, they grow faster than the other stuff you want to grow. This, if you want more of it, make more of it. If you don't, whatever, just trim it every once in a while.
That one's an excellent choice. Yeah. I love it.
And I don't know that it's that around anymore.
But we do have some, right?
I have some. I bring it in frequently, but now that we've got those really nice tanks dedicated to plant propagation, I will probably bring some into that.
I have seen it show up on wholesale lists.
It does, but I've seen it show up tissue culture.
Yeah, that's weird.
And it's why would you want that plant tissue? What? I don't know. I'm not even going to get into the whole tissue culture thing right now. I don't get it.
I don't want snails, okay?
Oh, please. Yeah, I love that plant.
Good
That's call. My last one.
I like it.
Are
Charles,
we all?
You have the last
one. You have
plant.
One more?
I do. It's Java fern.
Ah, ha, ha.
That's a plant that I can almost never get someone to buy. And that is a plant. So, fun fact, I sung the praises of Anubias, and I don't have any in my home tanks right now because I slowly traded it out for Java fern because that's an Asian plant. Most of the fish I'm breeding are Asian fish.
Is it from Java?
It's from the Asian region.
Okay. But do they find it in Java?
To my knowledge, yes.
Okay.
God, thank we don't have to change the name of something else.
Right.
It's probably my favorite epiphyte.
Mm-hmm.
It's got that, I don't know, just the shade of green it has specifically when it's growing well. That's one of my favorite shades of green. And it's got that like weird texture, and it's just
almost papery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a cool plant to look at.
Yeah.
Yeah. No arguments.
No
Any
argument.
Of the forms. I when mean, I think they're all beautiful.
When that one is growing well, it's gorgeous. Big, yeah. Huge, flowy, bushy portions of Java fern. Love it.
And it grows well in the conditions that I keep it in. So I love it.
Yeah. I think you have ideal conditions for it. Lots of people, even people who keep planted tanks, struggle with Java fern because of the browning.
It's definitely one of those plants that either thrives or dies. It does. There's no in between with that one.
And I think that your frequent water changes are probably the solution. We've talked about you mineral dosing your tank with water changes.
Yeah.
And I think that that's why people struggle with Java fern and you don't.
It pulls out too many minerals and then just can't do well once it's exhausted them.
And a lot of people keeping planted tanks do fewer water changes because they don't need to do them for nutrients, and I think Java fern suffers from that.
I think that's a good explanation.
And one of its big benefits for me is that since it can grow on a surface, like a piece of wood or a rock, that means it's very easy to move around between my tanks to I need it most.
Right.
Without it being upset about it.
That's a great point.
Yeah. That's a good, I would say, so when you first brought that one up, my thought was, that's not necessarily an underrated plant because it's a pretty common one in the hobby, but using it for breeder tanks is less common, which makes it underrated for the purpose Charles is using it for.
Mm-hmm.
See, I love it because it's great for Cory cats, any of the ones that like to deposit their eggs on plants.
Oh, yeah.
What I use it for. Or in tanks where I'm breeding bettas, especially bubble nesters, because it'll grow floor to ceiling in the tank. And that gives the female the ability to get air because without being seen by the male if she doesn't want to be, because it goes all the way to the top.
Oh, that's perfect. I love that.
Yeah. And they can rest on top of those leaves too. Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah. That's an excellent choice.
Yeah. For great reasons too. Huh? This was a fun one, guys. I think we got a lot of plants out there.
I know. That's pretty cool. I think we're going to generate some excitement. We brought up some plants that hopefully we can find more of. We brought up some plants we have in stock all the time that hopefully we've generated some excitement for.
What's your favorite plant? Why are you mad that we didn't talk about it?
Yeah. Yeah, there's everybody's got a torch to bear for something.
Right, right. There were a couple of them that I didn't mention, and so maybe we're going to have to save those for some later podcasts. What are some plants out there? So if the theme is underrated,
yeah,
what are some plants you guys keep that you can't believe no one's heard of?
Yeah.
And I feel the need to say that I feel like plants are a little bit different than fish, where I'm not sure it's worthwhile to do a podcast on overrated plants, because like I feel like plants that are really popular kind of earned it.
Oh, I could think of a way to do an overrated plant.
I'm not sure I could. So maybe that would have to be like you being like, so here's my reasoning, and I'll
here's
be like
my soapbox. I'm going to stand on it for
a
while.
I've got a couple of soapboxes for overrated plants.
Yeah. I think that might
it's going to be like 90% of floaters and 90% of carpeting plants.
Mm. Okay, so I guess I can agree to carpeting plants, although as a betta guy, any floating plant is a godsend.
This is going to turn into a whole other discussion. Maybe we should wrap it up.
Yeah, I like it.
Please send any of your feedback, any of your opinions, any of your underrated plants to podcast@watercolorsaquariumgallery.com. Be sure to check out our YouTube channel, our Instagram, our Facebook, our Twitter, and get in touch however you can.
And if you're looking for a particular type of plant, call us and let us know so that we can put it on the list and try to get it in for you.
Yeah, we've got long plant lists, so we might be able to get you what you want.
Quick shout out once again to Crystal Castleman and her amazing book, Aquarium Plants, and Esther Mouse at Aquaflora, and Karen Randall with her book, Sunken Gardens. And whoever else we brought up and need to make sure.
Oh, so many people.
But
props to Crystal for writing a, like, what is this, 500, 600 page plant book that I'm like, got to flip through this real quick here. Like,
right. Yeah, you did not think that would be a thing, did you?
No, they brought it in. I'm like, okay.
Yeah, amazing.
Yep. Well, let's have lots of fun and keep those hands wet.